This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Backsliders and unrepentant atheists and irreverent agnostics living for today. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
And I'm your friendly neighborhood atheist, Dan Barker. This is the weekend of June 12th and 13th, 2010.
Free Thought Radio is broadcasting in Madison, Wisconsin, also broadcasting in some diverse places, including Atlanta, Anchorage, Grand Rapids, Monterey, and podcasting everywhere.
Free Thought Radio, this show is a weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the country's largest organization of non-believers, atheists, and agnostics.
Yeah, and we ran a count last week, or actually Monday, and we're at 16,000 supporters, Dan.
More than 16,000?
Including 500 subscribers and about 15,400 members.
Remember when you started with three?
I do remember. It was a kitchen table operation. And that signing up more than 1,000 members since we won the district court ruling in the National Day of Prayer.
In April, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And many others, thousands and thousands have contacted us. So welcome to new members.
Welcome and thank you for joining. As you know, our group works to promote and educate about the views of non-believers, but just as important, we work to keep religion and government separate. Annie Laurie, you were gone this last weekend, and you just came back from the American Humanist Association convention in San Jose, and you and the feminist Meg Bowman, you shared an award, the annual Humanist Heroine Award. Was that it? How did that go?
Yeah, I called us the Humanist Co-Heroines. It's because we co-chaired the AHA's Feminist Caucus together for many years, and so they awarded us together, and I was very honored to become part of a long list of Humanist Heroine awardees, and starting with Sonia Johnson, the former Mormon feminist who was excommunicated because of her role in supporting the Equal Rights Amendment and exposing the role of the Mormon Church in defeating the ERA. And she's a friend, my own mother, Annie and Nicole Gaylor, principal founder of FFRF, was 85 heroine. Women like Christine Kraft, I was taking a look at the list, and you remember, if you're old enough, that she was the very cute news anchor in Kansas City who was fired in 1981 for being too old, too unattractive, and not deferential enough to men, and took a lawsuit. She sued Metro Media. And women like Kristen Lems, we've had her on our program, the Midwest feminist folk singer and feminist, Loretta J. Ross, Kate Michaelman, former executive director of NARAL, lots and lots of these women all putting their energies into improving this world, particularly for women, and not worrying about some unknowable, unprovable afterlife.
We haven't had Meg Bowman on the show yet, have we?
We'll have to have her on, and some of the others. I don't think we've had Loretta Ross.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Danil McCollum. He's a former mayor of Champaign, Illinois. He's a non-believer. He comes from what we like to call the first family of non-believing humanist and state church litigants. He's written a book called The Lord Was Not on Trial, The Inside Story of the Supreme Court's Precedent-Setting McCollum Ruling.
And that was the famous 48 ruling by the Supreme Court against religious instruction in the public schools. This is the prevailing law. We frequently invoke it at the foundation in our letters of complaint about religious violations in our public schools. And the McCollum precedent solves a lot of problems.
And Danil was one of the young children in that lawsuit.
And now we've got a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Since it's summertime and the living is easy, we have a little music. And in a few minutes, we're going to celebrate the life of the very secular Cole Porter. He was a composer who had to come out of two closets, non-believer and gay. He was born in the month of June, and his free-thinking philosophy was live and let live.
And we're going to talk about two feisty women, with strong views on the separation between church and state in this segment.
First, let's talk a minute about what Ayaan Hirsi Ali is up to these days. We interviewed Ayaan last March on Free Thought Radio. She's the Somali exile who travels with bodyguards because she's criticized the Muslim religion's treatment of women, and she's a leading exponent of free thought globally. She's author of the poignant memoir, Infidel, which we sell. It's available at ffrf.org.
And she has a new book just out, Nomad, which is a very apt title for her, and she's been making the media rounds.
And by the way, she's accepted an invitation from us, from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, to headline our 33rd annual national convention. Ayaan Hirsi Ali will receive our coveted Emperor Has No Clothes Award. And that award is reserved for public speakers who...
Public figures
who make known their dissent from religion. So she's a very deserving candidate who really exemplifies what that award is all about.
So Ayaan Hirsi Ali will be speaking and receiving that award at the FFRF Annual Convention on Halloween weekend in Madison, Wisconsin, October 29th and 30th at the Concourse Hotel, along with Julia Sweeney, by the way, who will be appearing.
Let's listen to an amusing bit from Ayaan Hirsi Ali's recent appearance on the Stephen Colbert Show.
A number of Muslims, not all, a small number of Muslims use the argument, you, Stephen Colbert, if you say anything about the Prophet, if you say anything about the Quran that hurts me, I'm going to kill you. Ayaan, if you say you are leaving Islam, I'm going to kill you. That is a compelling argument.
Now, we're going to edit my name out of that, but... Ayaan, if you leave Islam, we are going to kill you. This threat has been made to you.
And, yeah.
It is a real threat.
Well, yeah. And
it is.
Yeah.
And have you left Islam?
I have left Islam.
And so now you are a Christian?
No, I'm not a Christian. I prefer John Locke to Jesus Christ. I prefer John Stewart to Jesus Christ.
I was afraid you were going to say you.
Locke,
I was going to say John Stewart for a second. That truly terrified me.
John Stewart to Jesus Christ. But
John, I think you might be due for a crucifixion. Now, but why not? Why not become why an atheist? Are you an atheist?
An atheist.
So you can sign up now or make plans to attend FFRF's national convention. You can hear and meet Ayaan Hirsi Ali in person.
And she'll sign a copy of her book, won't she?
Get a copy of Nomad signed by the author. And then we have another short clip from that very funny interview on the Stephen Colbert Show.
I mean, I've been to church with some Christians and I got the little thin thing.
The Eucharist?
The waffle.
The body of Christ. God incarnate, yes.
And I had no idea that it was that, so I put it in my pocket.
You know what? For later, you're hungry for Jesus.
That's funny. She's talking about the wafer. She called it a waffle.
Yeah. Well, and we had that student on, remember, who was, they were going to press charges on him for stealing the communion wafer.
Webster
he was
Cook.
One of Webster Cook.
Yeah. Now, another feisty woman in the news, Helen Thomas.
Now, she's been all over the news this week, and we have to say something about her because we were lucky enough to meet her. She accepted an invitation from us radical atheists to address our body when we had a convention in Washington, D.C. And we wanted her to speak at that time. That was during the Bush era. She was one of the strongest columnists against the faith-based initiative, very, very pro-separation of church and state, and, of course, is a liberal Christian. Her family is very well known to be from Lebanon. She's first generation.
And you probably know what she said last weekend.
Oh, I just wanted to say one more thing about that convention.
Yeah.
We had three speakers for Friday night, two of them at the last possible minute, no shows. One was sick and one just left. And I met Helen Thomas in the lobby and was kind of, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Telling her what was going on. And she said, I had invited her to speak for 15 minutes because I'd only heard her speak that long at another conference and thought maybe she didn't do longer speeches because of her age and time. And she said, well, I have a 45-minute speech. And, the audience ate her up. It was just wonderful.
Yeah.
She was such a trooper and so kind to us.
So what she said last, what it came into the news that she had said, which caused her to retire last week, it was unfortunate the way she phrased it, but it was a bit of a setup. There was a rabbi walking around the White House for this Jewish Heritage Month on May 27th, Why isn't there like an Atheist Heritage Month at the White House?
Wouldn't that be cool?
Here's a little bit of his quick interview with Helen Thomas, which got her into trouble. She's the grand dame of White House correspondents.
Any comments on Israel? We're asking everybody today. Any comments
on Israel?
Tell
them to get the hell out of Palestine.
Ooh. Any better comments?
Helen is one.
Remember, these people are occupied. It's their land. It's not German. It's not Poland.
So where should they go? What should they do?
They go home.
Where's the home?
Poland.
So the Jews,
Germany.
You say the Jews go back to Poland and Germany?
And America and everywhere else.
Well, okay, so that was a callous way to put that. I remember my pediatrician, a very well-known physician, Dr. Honey Reese in Madison, Wisconsin, one of only two survivors in her extended family in Poland. So the image of Jews going back to Poland, Germany, not so great. But Palestine is an occupied land, and what she said was very true. So in that respect. I know you have some feelings on this.
Well, it'd be kind of like, I'm a member of the Delaware tribe of American Indians, the Lenape tribe. We are the very smart tribe who sold Manhattan to the Dutch for $24. And what if my brothers and I were to say, we want our holy land back? That's the land that our God and our Delaware religion gave us that land. And all you Big Apple interlopers have to get out of the way because we're coming back to rehabit that. People would see things a lot differently if that were to happen.
So I guess we just, don't we have free speech in this country? Can't you make a mistake? She did apologize. And I guess what bothers me is the sexism of the reaction. I'm looking particularly at New York Times writer Jeremy M. Peters' story, where there were a number of male reporters quoted against her. They pointed out with great envy that she had a chair with her own name. She was the only person not linked anymore to a newspaper or TV station, and there she was in the front row, and they really laid into her. And one of the things that Peters, this New York Times reporter, said in his supposedly objective write-up of what happened was that Ms. Thomas seemed to take particular offense to the Iraq War and repeatedly pointed out during White House briefings that the American-led invasion was costing lives. Well, I should hope one person in the press corps would do that. And you do remember, in the build-up to the Iraq War, Helen Thomas was almost by herself. She was disgusted with the other press corps in asking questions about that and making clear she thought this was an outrage. And then this reporter went to her archenemies, her natural adversaries, former White House press secretaries, for quotes about her. So, of course, Ari Fleischer hated her guts, and Dana Perino, they lit into her. So I thought that was about as fair and balanced as Fox TV.
Well, we all might disagree on these political issues, but don't we have free speech in this country? Can't we debate the policies of Israel, the fact that it was settled in part by people claiming that their God had given them holy rights to this land? We should be having the same kind of free and open debate in the United States that they are having themselves right there in Israel.
So it's a painful goodbye to Helen Thomas, who did issue a formal apology through Hearst, deeply regretting her comments, saying they did not reflect her heartfelt belief that peace will come to the Middle East only when all parties recognize the need for mutual respect and tolerance.
And since music has powers to soothe the savage beast. Savage breast.
Get it right.
What's both? A savage beast.
But the original quote is breast.
Let's go out with a short ode to Robert Schumann, who was a non-believing classical composer. He was born in June, on June the 8th, 1810. And we're listening to Traumerei, which is Dreams. Then we'll be back to talk some more music. We're going to look at Cole Porter in particular and talk with the author, Danil McCollum, whose book is The Lord Was Not on Trial.
Hi, my name is Bob Collins. I'm from Spring Lake, Michigan, on the other side of the lake from Chicago here. and I'm pleased to be on Free Thought Radio.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. How do you like that for an intro, right? Of course, we're listening to Richard Strauss, or is it pronounced Richard Strauss's most famous work from Thus Spake Zarathustra, which, by the way, was inspired by the freethinker Nietzsche. Richard Strauss, the German composer, was born June 11, 1864. He did not believe in God and saw no spiritual dimension in his art.
And we're going to talk about music and another musician, a very different kind of musician, Cole Porter, whose birthday was June 9th. He was born in the year 1891. As previously mentioned, Cole Porter was out of two closets, more or less. It was kind of hard to be out of a closet as a gay man when he was working. And he was also not religious.
Well, in the industry, he was known.
Yeah, he was known. His musicals include Anything Goes, Raise the Ire of Religionists. Some of those playful lyrics include, "You're a Nathan Panning, you're Bishop Manning, you're broccoli."
He was a tremendously successful tunesmith. He lived a lavish lifestyle, and he engaged in a lifelong battle with Puritanism and with censorship. As is true for many musicians, his art becomes almost a religion. When Cole Porter was admitted to the hospital for the final time, dangerously ill and miserable, his friend Bobby Raisin overheard an encounter between him and the staff. When he was asked what his religion was, Cole Porter replied, "Put down none." The clerk then asked, "Protestant?" And Cole repeated, "Put down none."
And so, since these are the slower days of summer, we're going to take a pause to enjoy some Cole Porter artistry and play his song, his philosophy, Live and Let Live. This is from Can Can.
Sin's tyranny overthrew and the fall of the Bastille. Tell a Frenchman what to do, or if you tell him what not to do, he will only give one look at you, but the look will be nasty. The France will always curl her lip and those will block her way. And to every form of censorship, the French will always say, Vive la liberté! Let live, be and let be, hear and let hear, see and let see, sing and let sing, dance and let dance. I like Offenbach, you do not, so what, so what, so what? Read, write and let write, love, write and let write, live and let live. And let be, hear, and let hear, see, and let see, drink, and let drink, eat, and let eat. You like bouillabaisse, I do not, so what, so what, so what? Pray, slip, and let slip, dress, strip, and let strip, live, and let live. Here's my
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker. We'll be right back to talk with Daniel McCollum, who will tell us what it was like to live as a small boy right in the thick of a huge challenge of religion in the public schools, which resulted in a huge state church victory for his family, for all of us, for the First Amendment. Dan McCollum is the author of the new book, The Lord Was Not on Trial.
And his mother used to have that philosophy. You can teach your children whatever you want. You can go to church and
live and let live.
Live and let live. Your business is your business, and my business is mine. We'll be right back.
I prefer John Stewart to Jesus Christ.
Hi, my name is Bob from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio.
Our guest today has written a book, The Lord Was Not on Trial, the inside story of the Supreme Court's precedent-setting McCollum ruling. Daniel McCollum grew up and has been a lifelong resident of Champaign, Illinois, where we're speaking with him by phone. He earned an AB, BS, and MS degrees, respectively, from the University of Illinois in political science, secondary education, and geography. He served in the U.S. Army, as so many freethinkers have, as a reserve officer and achieved the rank of captain. He's taught in public schools. He's written other books, including Your Life and Mine, Problems and Projects in Conservation. And very interestingly, from 1983 to 1999, Daniel McCollum served on the Champaign City Council, including three consecutive terms as mayor, and he had to turn them down when they asked him to run for a fourth term. He's currently Champaign City historian. As mentioned previously, he belongs to the first family of freethinking secular humanists. He's the second of three sons of John and Vashti McCollum.
So welcome to Free Thought Radio, Daniel.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you spell your name differently from me. You spell it D-A-N-N-E-L, right?
Well, my people are from Arkansas, and I'm named after a great-grandfather who was named Daniel Elisha McCollum. Huh. But down there, they leave a syllable or two out every once in a while, and so
he was known as Daniel.
I'm named the way they called him.
Well, I like it.
We've had your brother, Jim, on the show talking about the story, and many of our listeners will be familiar with the famous McCollum versus Board of Education case, which was decided, it was 1948, wasn't it?
The decision was in 1948.
That's right, and you were one of the little brothers in that case, which went clear to the United States Supreme Court, and in fact, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is still selling your mother's book, One Woman's Fight, which is a powerful story of the family, but you've written a book from your point of view, because you were there, and we also have this book, The Lord Was Not on Trial. It's a very up-close look at what happened to the issues. Tell us why you wrote the book.
Well, first of all, Vashti's book is a memoir. It was based upon her experiences recalled immediately after the decision. The book was written within a year or two of the decision in 1948. It wasn't actually printed or published until a couple of years later, but the fact was it was her immediate memories of the affair. Mine is as objective as possible of the entire affair. In other words, I interviewed people who were on both sides of the issue, the couple of attorneys who were surviving on the defendant's side, of course, and then people who supported my mother. The interesting thing is that I did not have to interview Vashti because she had pretty much said everything in her book.
So tell our listeners, what was the issue?
The issue was the invasion in the public school on school time, on school property, of sectarian religious instruction. And to make it play, they had a one class fits all for Protestants, a Catholic class. The Jewish community participated for a year or two, but their population was so small they pretty much abandoned it. So it was really a Catholic and a Protestant class, which I think clearly established the sectarian nature of it.
And then for those of you who didn't participate, it was basically the equivalent of detention, wasn't it?
Again?
It was basically the equivalent of detention for those who didn't participate?
Oh, it, well, since the Protestant class took in most of the pupils, the people who did not sign up for the instruction then had to go elsewhere.
So you had, like, to the principal's office or sit out in the hall? Or?
Well, they put Jim out in the hall once, and then that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Bastion was ready to file suit the next minute.
Because your family is not a Christian family. You're secular humanist then, basically.
Yeah, we are definitely of the unchurched.
Yeah.
Now, we have a clip of your mother talking about the story. Before we get your take on it, why don't we hear, it's Vashti 1 there, Brian?
We have three sons. When the oldest one was in the fourth grade, he ran into this program of religious education in the school, public school, on school time. He came home with a note from the teacher that we were supposed to sign, give him permission to participate. We didn't approve of it. We thought that it was religious indoctrination. It was the sort of thing that shouldn't be in public schools. And also, we didn't want the religious training in any case. So we kept him out of the class until the peer pressure became so great. Even the public school teacher called and asked that we permit him to participate. Finally, we let him take the course for a few weeks. And we saw that it was pure and simple religious indoctrination. It wasn't a course in general morality and good, home, happy living. And so we took him out of the course. The pressure continued, and when it came to the point that we couldn't resist it, I took it to court.
Now, before we continue, Daniel, tell me again how you pronounce your mother's name.
Well,
you say Vashti.
Or Vashta. My father called her Vashta. I always called her Vashta, but I think probably a more appropriate pronunciation would be Vashti.
And tell us again where that name came from.
It's in the first book of Esther in the Bible. This lady who was married to the king Ahasuerus was called upon by the king to entertain his drunken courtiers and other subordinates to dance in front of them. And she had some virtue and declined. Well, you couldn't have that in that kind of a situation in that time and place. And
she disobeyed her husband.
He had to put her down and married another woman called Esther.
So I remember reading your mother's book and how she was proud that she was named for what she called the first exponent of women's rights. So
I think it fit.
Mm-hmm. So following in those footsteps, now, I know that you wrote a kind of objective treatise about this case, but how old were you when this first started to unfold?
I was nine at the time that it was, wait a minute. I was seven at the time it was filed and nine at the time of the decision.
So did you ever have to go to one of the classes, or were you ever confronted with the choice?
Well, I was given the permission form like all the other students in the fourth grade when the program and I encountered each other. But of course, everyone knew our position, so it was just a moot point. I never was interested in taking the class, and nobody pushed the issue. But it was certainly a disability with respect to my fellows. The problem is that it segregated people. It isolated people, particularly minority people. If you were a Seventh-day Adventist who actually had one pupil that accompanied me, you were ostracized to a considerable extent.
I remember you were talking about how you had to get creative on how you got to and from school. What does that mean?
Well, it means that you encountered difficulties on the way home, and there were some fights. It just wasn't pleasant outside of school, particularly on those days that the class occurred.
So when your mother took this fight and, you know, lost it, it was very dramatic because she kept losing. But she knew she was right, and she took it all the way to the Supreme Court and won. And Jim had been moved out of state, right, because it was so much pressure on him, your older brother, who was the plaintiff?
Definitely, it was extremely severe on Jim, and they needed to get him out of town. So he spent the probably 2 years of the time that the case was in the courts with at the home of his maternal grandparents.
And your maternal grandfather was a famous freethinker in his own right.
Well, I like to describe him as a village atheist of some regional repute.
And so when your mother won, and of course it was a wonderful moment for your family, and she was all over the front pages, how did that play out when you went back to school?
When the case would sort of die down between major events. So the major events in the case, first when she filed the case in June of 1945, and then at the September trial in the local circuit court, of course, there was headlines all over the place. Then the appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, and finally the Supreme Court hearing and decision in which came in March 1948. Those were the times when the mail went wild, the headlines went wild, and most of the nasty phone calls occurred.
Well, when we come back, maybe we can listen to a clip of your mother talking about some of the reaction that she got. We're talking with Danil McCollum. He's the author of the book called The Lord Was Not on Trial, the inside story of the Supreme Court's precedent-setting McCollum ruling. I'm Dan Barker. I'm here with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and you're listening to Free Thought Radio.
I'm Michael Newdow, and this is Free Thought Radio.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker. We are talking with author Danil McCollum. His book is The Lord Was Not on Trial, the inside story of the Supreme Court's precedent-setting McCollum ruling. Danil McCollum was three-time mayor of Champaign, Illinois, and comes from the McCollum first family of freethought and secularism. His mother, Vashti McCollum, took the landmark challenge that resulted in the McCollum versus Board of Education court victory in 1948, keeping religious instruction out of the public schools. And we were just talking with you, Danil, about how you had to take creative ways home from school, and then what it was like in 1948 when you were there at 9 years old and your family had just won this very controversial Supreme Court case where you really had gotten a huge amount of flack locally and nationally.
Well, there's no question that the 8-1 decision was pretty validating. And even though the circuit court, the local court of first instance, and the state Supreme Court had ruled in support of the Board of Education, clearly when the Supreme Court spoke, it really knocked down the opposition. And I don't really recall too much trouble after that. The local Board of Education immediately, in their first board meeting, canceled the program.
Let's listen to your mother talking about some of the religious reaction during the time, and then you can comment after we hear her.
We had church services devoted to this discussion of this woman. And, of course, the children made it pretty hard on our boy that didn't take the course. There was a lot of publicity, and the publicity, and, well, it just created a lot of furor in the community. Well, we had plenty of telephone calls all hours of the day and night, and I think sometimes after it seemed that Sunday evenings were the very worst when they'd heard a good sermon that morning on the subject, and then they would go home and think it over. They'd call me and they'd give me the works about filing this case and objecting to their children having religion in the schools. And of course, I didn't mind their religion for their children. It was a very good idea if that's what they wanted. It's just that I didn't want religion for my children, and if I did want it, I would have it on my own conditions, and that wasn't in the public school.
So, Daniel, you must have felt, as a part of that family, that you were sometimes under siege.
Well, very fortunately, our family was very close-knit, and unfortunately, in contrast to, say, the Madeline Murray family, we felt pretty well self-contained and a unit that could easily defend itself psychologically. I don't think I ever doubted either my parents' vision or sincerity in this issue. I just assumed they were right, and as a matter of fact, as an adult, thinking back on it, knew darn good and well they were right.
Yes, and anybody who's met your mother, who had the pleasure of meeting your mother, what a stalwart and what a just an absolutely wonderful person Vashti was. And she said she never thought of giving up. Now, in the break...
There was never an issue. I mean, I think that's the reason why the Chicago Action Council, which was a group of young Jewish businessmen and lawyers in Chicago, backed her, was that they were pretty sure that she would see the matter through, that she was not going to quit after a loss or two.
And now, during the break, we were talking about, I was asking you what struck you when you were doing the research on your book about this case, The Lord Is Not on Trial. You talked to friend and foe alike when you could, didn't you?
Right, I did. The lead attorney, John Franklin, for the school board, was very accommodating, and I had a very nice relationship with him, as well as a couple of other people who were associated on the other side.
When you finished the book, you told me that what struck you was the transitory nature of this victory, even though it is still the prevailing law.
Well, Supreme Court decisions are not self-enforcing. So in other words, if there was a program, let's say, in the Urbana, the next city over, to obtain a judgment there, you'd have to file a separate case. In other words, it doesn't mandate the end of religious instruction everywhere. The issue has to be raised every time. So that was a problem. And I think in the long term, we assumed that the precedent had been established, only to find that in Zorach versus Clausen, in an almost meaningless distinction drawn there.
Now, Zorach versus Clausen was 1952, and that was the release time decision.
The only significant difference was where the students left the building. But the school authorities still orchestrated the whole thing. They enforced attendance in the religious classes, and the students who didn't take the religious classes stayed in school. So the machinery of the school system was still employed for sectarian purposes.
And I told you that we have had so many release time headaches recently, really egregious violations of even the release. I don't like the release time decision, but not even attempting to follow the law in that regard. So, and then you had some insight, and we only have about a minute left, on you lost, who did you lose in the Zorach case? Douglas. And you thought that was for political reasons?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that Justice Douglas was being considered for the vice presidential slot on the Truman ticket. And I think that influenced his decision. It was a 5-4 decision the other way.
Okay, but I do want to say that your case, the McCollum decision, is a very strong precedent, and we've been using it for years.
Successfully.
And it's been a wonderful, because you can scare school boards with it, say, look, it, here's the law of the land. This case was decided, and do they want to take another losing case? So
we have had to in one case in the Sixth Circuit, which we won at the Sixth Circuit level. But
well, thank you for being with us today, Daniel.
It was my pleasure.
Daniel McCollum's book is The Lord Was Not on Trial, the inside story of the Supreme Court's precedent-setting McCollum ruling, and it's available from...
Yes, we have it for sale at ffrf.org, and it's got a really lovely picture of Vashti on the cover, all kinds of good information, recap of the lawsuit, recap of the people, recap of the trial, and a personal memoir. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We also want to thank our engineer and producer, Brian Tarani. And Brian, you're on a fundraiser for, why don't you tell our listeners briefly what you're raising money for here?
Yeah, it's my third year doing the ACT Ride. It's AIDS Network Cycles Together. It benefits the AIDS Network of South Central Wisconsin.
And you're a bike rider then.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, I put on about 8,500 miles while I was away from the radio station last year.
So people can donate. How can they help you out?
You can find out more about the ride and the work that AIDS Network does and give money to the ride at actride.org. It's actride.org.
And they can sponsor you too, right?
Yeah, yeah. If you click on donate when you get to that page, just search out Brian when you want to find a participant.
And we are sponsoring you.
You are. Thank you guys
and
so much.
You want
so
to raise $3,000. So
yep, that's the goal.
You hear it, viewers, at least those are listeners in Madison.
Who would have thought a non-believer doing charitable work?
Imagine that.
We also want to thank our announcer, Buzz Kemper. This show is recorded in Madison, Wisconsin. You can sign up for the podcast at our website, ffrf.org/radio, or you can listen to all previous shows.
Ask for information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Support Free Thought Radio's broadcast and podcast by becoming a member. Support our important litigation, our mop-ups of the McCollum ruling, for example. And you can ask for a sample of our newspaper Free Thought Today. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope someday.